Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from a pop-up Chinese studio here in Beijing. Happy New Year to all of our listeners. Joining me, of course, is co-host Jeremy Goldcorn, a.k.a. Jin Yuni, the man behind Danwei.com. How are you, sir?
Very good evening to you, Kaiser.
And we are delighted to have with us Ian Johnson. Ian, bring back the Taiping Johnson, reporter for the New York Times in Beijing, frequent contributor to the New York Review of Books, a veteran China correspondent who was formerly bureau chief of the Wall Street Journal here in Beijing and then in Berlin before coming back to China on his mission to bring back the Taiping. Welcome back to Seneca, Ian.
I'm glad to be here.
That's sort of an inside joke here, and it may be explained one day. But also joining us is the newly promoted Jeremiah Jenny, Qing History PhD candidate who has just risen to the august rank of director of the IES program, Beijing. Great to have you back on the show, Jeremiah, and congrats.
Great to see you again, Kaiser. Thank you.
So let's just jump right in. So no rest for the wicked. 2012 was a white-knuckled, edge-of-your-seat kind of year for anyone with an interest in China. And so far, the young 2013 is proving to be no less so. On January 3rd, while most of China was taking the last day of the official Yuandan New Year holiday, the editorial staff at the Southern Weekly, flagship newspaper of the liberal Guangzhou-based Southern Group of Publications, was embroiled in a fight with provincial propaganda officials over their heavy-handed 11th-hour reworking of the paper's traditional New Year's editorial. In the week to follow, media watchers within and without China have been riveted to events as this very high-profile challenge to state media controls continues to fascinate. We've had strikes, massive public reactions on Weibo and elsewhere on the internet, expressions of solidarity by many other leading media outlets, and now a possible compromise in the works. So today, we'll focus on understanding what brought on this crisis, what's at stake, and what this might mean for understanding the approach that the new leadership under Xi Jinping might be taking toward media liberalization in China in the coming years. And just a reminder to our guests here, this is one of those stories where it'll be really easy for a bunch of China hands to get very deep into the weeds. So let's make sure that we make this discussion as accessible as we can manage, guys, okay? So let's go to it. Jeremy, why don't you help me set this up? What was the original content of the New Year's editorial, and what was changed by Guangdong propaganda officials, allegedly, though this is also in question, by provincial propaganda chief Tuo Jin?
As I understand it, it was an editorial urging China to take its constitution seriously. And this is obviously an issue that has a great deal of resonance in this country, and it's something that the Communist Party themselves promised to do in the 1920s. Then there was interference, and I've seen a few different accounts of them, but basically the guy blamed is Mr. Tuo Jin, the head of the Guangdong Province Propaganda Department, who basically replaced this editorial with a vanilla homily along the lines of Xi Jinping's China dream.
Okay. Ian.
Is that right, Ian?
Yeah, I think that's
the complicated
story. Yeah.
Ian, let's go to you. The person at the center of this controversy, as Jeremy said, is Tuo Jin. He himself is a former journalist, a reporter, who took up his current role as propaganda chief for Guangdong in May of last year, May of 2012, if I remember correctly. My understanding is that the Southern Group really chafed during his tenure in office so far, that this was sort of a last straw, that the demand for his removal was topping their list of demands because of this. Did he, in fact, have a hand in redrafting the New Year's editorial on constitutionalism?
Well, I don't think that's entirely clear. Normally, the censors, the propaganda people, don't directly rewrite copy. Normally, they instruct people what to do, and they give overall guidelines for what should be done. The story now is that maybe he indicated to somebody what should have been done or how it should be rewritten, and maybe didn't do it directly himself. In any case, he clearly had a fairly direct role in the issue.
So, Jeremiah, help our listeners to understand what could possibly be objectionable to conservatives within the party leadership over calls for a strict observance of the Chinese constitution. I mean, was this some kind of a dog whistle to, say, foreign hostile forces?
At the risk of being considered a member of the hostile foreign forces.
Too late.
Yeah. It is kind of a dog whistle because this goes back to, you know, questions of constitutionalism and constitutionalism being a code for things like popular rights that dates back to the early 20th and even to some extent the late 19th century, which perhaps we can talk about later. But, you know, when you think about the early 20th century and the formation of the two main political parties at the time, the Kuomintang and, of course, the Communist Party, both of whom by the 1920s and into the 1930s began to see kind of ideas of universal rights or constitutionalism as being antithetical to their goals of trying to put together a strong state and unifying the nation behind a strong state.
As they both embraced Leninist forms of party organization. Right?
Exactly. And I don't know if that has ever really changed, at least on the mainland. To some extent, too, it also harkens back to the attitudes that you would find among the government of the late Qing as well in the first decade of the 20th century, when they were also facing not inconsiderable demands for constitutionalism rights, and those two terms being thrown around quite a bit as people began looking for perhaps a new way forward.
Aside from the historical resonances, I mean, Ian, what about the shutdown, apparent shutdown of Yanhuang Chunqiu? It's a magazine, a small circulation written mostly by elderly gentlemen who've spent their entire lives in the Communist Party, but it's known for its reformist views. And their last issue was also constitutionalism was a big theme. And it appears that the website has been shut down and the magazine taken off the shelves. Is that right? And, I mean, is there a connection with the Southern Weekly because of the idea of constitutionalism? Is that spooking the propaganda authorities?
Well, clearly their website was closed down. The authorities say it was just because of a technicality and it'll be back up again in a week or two.
Ah, I see. I didn't realize that.
But I think the link is that everybody sees and is pushing for some sort of reform in China. You had that petition late last month in late December for the government to take the constitution and to take rule of law seriously. You have these two publications that are doing it as well. So there's a big demand for some sort of and a big expectation that the new administration can do something and will do something. Mm-hmm. There's a pent-up demand for reform. That's what I think is really going on.
Okay, so let's get back to sort of the chronology of events following Thursday and the intrusive editorial decision that was made. What happened next? Apparently, there was a tussle over who controlled the official Nanfang Zhoumo's, the Southern Weekly's Weibo account. Can maybe, Jeremy, you enlighten us as to what happened there?
I didn't follow that closely enough, I'm afraid. But
well, no, I mean, they were sending out notes saying there was even a petition with, I think, 90 people signed it saying our Weibos are no longer controlled by us. In other words, they're controlled by the authorities.
Right.
And you can sort of imagine, I wonder what was going on, you know, passwords being changed at the last minute and things like that, or people physically gaining control of the microblogs. It was quite dramatic. And then these things were all, of course, knocked offline, but then people were taking screenshots of the petitions and sending them around, and it was really exciting for a while.
This is the modern-day equivalent of seizing control of the television station.
Exactly, right.
There were, of course, street protests beginning on, I believe it was Saturday or Sunday.
And going on to today.
And going on all the way to today. Yeah. That's right. So what kind of a scale did the protests actually reach, both in Guangzhou at the headquarters of the Southern Weekly?
Well, we're seeing pictures on Twitter by journalists who are there of people being pulled away. I don't think they're massive protests, but the fact that people even dare to go out and do this kind of thing is indicative of something going on. Petitioners showing up saying Southern Weekly was the only publication that wrote our stories, all kinds of things like that. It is quite remarkable. Given
people using fairly direct language in their little signs that were carrying slogans that, you know, were more direct than one sees the average petitioner who's just, you know, they talked about freedom of speech. Using those words.
I think it was interesting, too, because there was a fairly lively counter-protest that materialized as well with people holding pictures of Chairman Mao.
The angry Maoist.
If they go carrying pictures of Chairman Mao, they ain't going to make it with anyone anyhow.
Well, that's not true in China.
Well, you know it's going to be all right. Ian, there was also an extraordinary outpouring of support for Southern Weekly from other media outlets. What were some of the ways in which that support was expressed?
Well, I think most dramatically was the sister publication in Beijing News, which was forced late at night the other night to publish an editorial criticizing Southern Weekly, and the editors threatened to resign. There was a very dramatic standoff in the newspaper's newsrooms. This was recounted. Some of this was written down by a sobbing editor who said, mm-hmm. "We did everything we could to stand up for this, and we weren't really interested in Southern Weekly until they came and shoved this down our throats." And so you do see people are kind of at a breaking point to some
and
degree.
And then, interestingly enough, two very popular figures, Li Bingbing and Yao Chan, two of the most famous and popular actresses in China, tweeted to their Weibo accounts messages of support for the Southern Weekly.
Yeah, what did you make of that, of these ordinarily pretty apolitical characters who have enormous followings on Weibo, sort of wading in with Yao Chen making references to Solzhenitsyn? I can't imagine her having ever read Solzhenitsyn.
Oh, no, don't be hard on Yao Chen. This is consistent with her tweets. She's been a socially responsible and somewhat politicized tweeter, I think.
I think her parents' home was going to be torn down or
right,
something.
Or relatives of her. She was tweeting about the demolition, and she's done other kind of slightly sensitive social justice tweeting works.
And well, Fan Bingbing, I've never heard getting into
it. No, was it Fan Bingbing or Li Bingbing?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Li Bingbing.
I get the two
Li Bingbing.
Hot Bingbings mixed up all the time.
Yeah, Li Bingbing.
They're both astonishing. Anyway, sorry.
I wonder, too, when you have celebrities Weiboing about this, and it's easy to kind of dismiss this as sort of, political dilettantes. But at the same time, I think you bring up a good point, Kaiser, that on Weibo, where a lot of Weibo users and a lot of people of note tend to be rather apolitical, the fact that people actually stopped and paid attention to this particular incident, I think it has a certain amount of significance. Not that it obviously much is going to come out of this in the short term, but I do think the fact that this became an excuse for for ordinary people to kind of rubberneck the fight between a newspaper and the censorship bureau, I think that in and of itself kind of makes the censorship bureau a little bit uncomfortable because they do their best work when nobody sees them doing mm-hmm. it. I mean, it's almost like the bass player. If you can really, really hear him in the mix, something is wrong.
Or you're Rush.
Right.
Or yes.
This is not, by the way, Seneca Rock.
Okay, well, I'll be taking off that.
The other show. Anyway.
Right.
Just don't start with baseball metaphors, okay?
I won't. No inside baseball either. Let's see. Let's make sure to point out that Evan Osnos has written a very good piece on this particular topic on these celebs, either Miss One of the Bingbings and Yao Chen.
And he said, I think that Yao Chen has 31 million followers.
Yeah.
Which is quite stunning. So that will get out to a number of people.
It sure will. Although the reference was obscure enough so that I'm not sure many people will have understood it completely. So in addition to, of course, the solidarity that was expressed by the Beijing Daily, there were other publications that used sort of clever and kind of subtly subversive techniques to show support. Many of the websites that were also obliged to run the very critical Global Times editorial, for example...
Sorry, Kaiser, just to correct you, not the Beijing Daily. You misspoke. The Beijing News.
All right, I'm sorry, the Beijing News. Right.
The thing that you referred to, they ran I think it was a full page, or it took up most of a page in the cooking and lifestyle section, and it was a hymn to the glories of porridge from the south, Nanfang de Zhou, which is a pun, obviously, on Nanfang Zhou Mo on Southern Weekend.
Yeah, that's very, very clever. Kanji of the South. Before that ran a couple of days ago, when other publications were compelled to run, especially online publications were compelled to run the Global Times editorial, they included, for the first time that I've ever seen, maybe somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, but a sort of disclaimer saying the editorial below does not reflect the editorial position of this publication. NetEase did that. Sina did that. A couple of people did that. And then, of course, there were these very clever acrostics. There were a couple of websites that ran headlines that were totally unrelated, apparently, to what was happening. But if you looked at only the first characters of the headlines, they read things like "Nanzhou Jiayou," like
go
go go Nanfang Zhoumo. That was I thought extremely. That was truly extraordinary. Anything to add to that one?
No, I think it was. It's a sign of this pent up demand, and I think that in some ways it's unfair, or it's unfortunate for Xi Jinping, because even if he has the strongest reformist tendencies, he hasn't had a chance really to take control of the government. The National People's Congress hasn't happened yet, and he's just kind of new in office. But there is this pent-up demand, and so they have their traditional New Year's message and sent it out, and there's been the first crisis, really, of his administration.
What do you think it was that made the editors actually choose this moment, or did they choose it?
Well, their January 1st message is traditionally fantastic. The former editor, Chang Ping, mm-hmm. in 1999, he wrote a beautiful a call for China to push forward with rule of law, and it's really something worth looking at again. You can find it online. And this has just been a tradition of theirs.
One should note, of course, Chang Ping lost his job not too long after that.
He's now living in exile.
Apparently not welcome in the People's Republic.
And Chang Ping actually wrote an extraordinary South China Morning Post op-ed the other day. I believe it was South China Morning Post.
I think so, yes. It was translated into English,
But do you think that the timing was necessarily good? I mean, would you, in hindsight, have chosen this moment, or do you think that maybe this puts the Xi administration, which is still very much finding its feet, does it put it in an awkward position? Does it possibly undermine what some were hoping was a reformist agenda? Was it forced
them?
It's
never a good time for a revolution. No, I don't know. It's not great, but. I think sometimes these things just get their own dynamic, and it's kind of hard to stop it.
Count me in the camp who doesn't see any reformist agenda on any senior leader's part. So, I mean, if people want press freedom, they're going to have to get to the barricades. You know, that's what it is. You know, it makes me want to start quoting lines from, Team America. You know, freedom isn't free. I mean, if you don't fight for it, you'll never get it, because this lot certainly aren't going to give it to you.
Well, and that was one of the touching things from the Sun Yat-sen University students when they were protesting in favor of Southern Weekend. And one of them said, "Our silence has brought us nothing. We acquiesced, and yet what have we got for it, for going along?"
And while I agree with Jeremy.
What about the roads?
And the high-speed railway. You go to Beijing in 8 hours.
Yeah. Right.
Well, there's the roads. And besides the roads and the high-speed rail, what have they ever done for
us? Well, we've got 360 buy as well. That helps a lot.
Okay, so besides the roads and the high-speed rails and 360 buy and the phenomenal e-commerce infrastructure. Okay, I'll stop with the life of Brian. What can we actually infer from Beijing's reaction to this about how serious a crisis they saw it as being? I mean, was this seen as maybe like the time in August of 89 when Hungary opened its borders to East German tourists, and that sort of led to what happened in November with the
I was there at the time. I traveled through East Germany in the summer of 89, but China is nothing like that. I mean, China has got a robust economy. The government's on top of things. East Germany was collapsing, and that's one of the problems that people have when they looking back at these other.
I'm not asking for.
No,
for,
I know, not a directive. Saying, but
but from the perspective of the CCP leadership, I mean, what made them so nervous about this that they were willing to really take? I'm pretty extraordinary. I mean, they went through and removed the censorship in the aftermath of this for anyone who had voiced support was pretty heavy-handed.
Well, I think, too, that they're kind of looking back at what's happened before. I mean, there have been times where the public mood has shifted such that what were once fringe ideas suddenly become mainstream. And again, if you take a look at that period, really, when constitutionalism as an idea first entered, the vocabulary, in the 1890s, the idea of constitutionalism of rights was really kind of limited to a few fringe characters. And by the 10 years later, the idea of rights and constitutionalism had become, if you will, so mainstream that for most people the idea of a modern nation was inseparable from the idea of rights in a constitution. And to the extent that the government itself started picking up the same terms and appropriating them in a way that they thought could help them to deflect calls for further reforms that might undermine their power. Now, again, I don't want to draw a parallel here saying, well, this is just like the end of the Qing dynasty, because of course it's not. And for the same reason that Ian just said, that you don't have a country that's on the verge of collapsing. But at the same time, the government seems to feel like it can, as was the case in the late Qing Dynasty, try to incrementally appropriate these ideas and reform or slightly reform its way out of this problem. And in essence, what the government of the Qing tried to do and what the government's trying to do now is Milton Berle the situation.
You're losing me. What does Frosty the Snow, or was it?
No, was he, you're thinking Berlioz. But Berlioz, Milton Berle, okay, right, in Hollywood was famous for, well, being a rather well-endowed human being. And the story goes that one night...
Where are we going here?
Where are we going here? Jeremiah?
If you'll let me finish, I'll tell you. Then one night he got into some sort of contest with another gentleman over whose was bigger. And when the guy came back to the table, everyone asked him, well, how big was this? And he goes, I don't know. He only pulled out enough to win. And the point being is that this is what the government's trying to do. They're just trying to pull out enough to win without actually thinking about what's the next step.
It's hard to come up with a rejoinder to that.
Yeah, I'm not even sure.
Let's end this
go
podcast
now.
Yeah,
I think. I want to go back. I want to talk a little bit more about the what I think was a lost opportunity here. I think that it seems to me that had they handled this differently in the initial days, it was an opportunity, I think, for the incoming Xi administration to sort of co-opt the leading voice on the left, and
you seem to be under the illusion that that they actually want some kind of.
I think there's plenty of evidence to suggest that there is.
I think you're under an illusion here. I mean, I think what they're going back to the Leninist playbook.
There are people getting
out of control. Crush them.
I don't know.
No,
that's
the way I see it.
No, I mean, because then we have at the same time. Meng Jianzhu, who's not exactly a leading light of liberalism within the administration, he's the former head of the Public Security Bureau, now talking about abolishing, then he backed off a little bit, at least reforming the Lao Jiao system, breaking the same day as this news is breaking. I mean, there are plenty of signs to suggest that, that he's backing off. I mean, in December, he already took down the vice party secretary of Sichuan province in a gigantic corruption probe. There's a lot going on. I mean, I don't think we can write off the fact that he's banned drinking by the military, that he's reduced the size of banquets, that he's having official...
Take away their Audis and Porsches. I mean,
that's right.
Just
call me cynical.
Add these things up,
and this is not just a single swallow here.
But this is exactly what I was saying before, Kaiser. I mean, you have the situation where they're giving away things that they feel like they can give up. Taking away their Audis and Porsches, reforming an extraordinarily unpopular...
No, but they're not. They took away their Maotai, not their Audis and Porsches.
Okay,
it's not
away their
serious.
Maotai, but the point is they're taking away the things they think they can take away.
They
and
can,
they're giving
of
the
course.
Things that they give... In terms of reform, but at the same time, when you get down to the very kind of fundamental aspects of reform, for example, like reducing the party's control over the media, or the idea of constitutionalism, whereby the party would be subject to its own to the constitution of the state, they're not giving an inch.
So, Ian, let's see how much of an inch they've given here, or whether how much of it they need to pull out. Ian, your paper ran a piece Thursday about a compromise that may have brought things at least to temporary conclusion. Can you tell our readers what the terms were that were ostensibly reached? This is Jonathan Asfield and Ed Wong who had written this. What are the basic terms? I mean, is this going to be one of these situations where they round up the ringleaders, they punish the ringleaders, and then they offer a sort of sacrificial lamb of their own? Is Tuo Jin going to go down?
Well, I think the rumor was that Tuo Jin was supposed to be going anyway. So perhaps they could just make him – he'll just leave a little bit earlier. That will give some face to the Southern Weekend side. And I think it's basically just we won't arrest anybody. Let's just play it calm and cool and go back to the way things were. But that's all it seems like to me.
And do we see any reason to think that the Southern Weekend – I mean my take is that they've shown real wisdom here, that they have some chips now. They've won some things. They've taken stock. They see the extent, the depth of popular support. And they can retreat and call it a victory.
Sure. I think that's right. I think it'll be just like with a lot of these crises, you have to look and see what happens in the months to come. If Southern Weekend recaptures some of the spirit it had in the 90s. I mean, back in the 90s, it was really much more of a crusading newspaper than it was in the 2000s. So if they can go back and push the envelope, consistently push the envelope on stuff – then, yeah, we might see that this was a victory and perhaps this will embolden others. I mean, it could snowball. I suppose there's a way to make a positive scenario. But I don't think that's really what the government wants. But who knows? Maybe they don't have a choice. I don't know.
Yeah, it's pretty opaque. Jeremiah, do you have a take on this? Do you have a forecast to make?
Well, I mean, I do think that this has kind of fizzled out, and I don't really think that there's anything going substantial is going to come out of this latest incident with Southern Weekly. You know, I think if there were sympathy strikes, if we see other newspapers who are taking or other groups that are taking their cues from Southern Weekly or taking heart from the stand that Southern Weekly journalists made, then perhaps that would be something to watch more closely. But I'm not particularly optimistic that we're going to see anything substantial, at least in the next, you know, next year. I mean, I don't want to sound too pessimistic, but I think it's going to be kind of status quo. This was an interesting blip, but it's a blip.
And one does also have to remember that, I mean, Southern Weekly has a purge at least once a year. You know, they do something that pisses somebody off and a senior editor loses their job, essentially. I mean, it happens, if not once a year, with enough regularity that one can see a similar cycle just playing out again, no?
The liberal reformer, High Colonic.
Well, speaking of High Colonics, the publisher, actually, of the Beijing News, of the Xinjingbao, apparently threatened in the wee hours of Wednesday morning to resign. And by all indications, he's still on the job right now. We're talking about Dai Zigong. What's the situation with him right now? Has he actually stepped down? Was it that offer not to resign not accepted?
Well, this was the dramatic situation I was alluding to earlier where he, by all accounts, by several eyewitness accounts, had threatened to resign over not running that editorial. The Beijing propaganda department says he's still on the job, according to the Wall Street Journal's China real-time blog, which has an account of the event. So it's another sign that there are, this has had some knock-on effect.
Yeah. Okay. So this is going to be obviously something that we're all going to be watching closely as things develop. But it's not just Chinese journalists that are sort of under the gun of late. The year ended on a not so happy note for foreign correspondents, just as it seems the new year seems to have begun on such a note for Chinese reporters. On December 31st, Chris Buckley, who had been hired by the New York Times away from Reuters, left China with his partner and their school-aged daughter after not getting a press credential and a new visa. Ian, as somebody who works with Chris, can you explain what really happened? I think there's a lot of misunderstanding out there about how your paper hasn't used the word expelled.
Right.
Well, can you give us an update on the situation with Chris?
Chris was hired by the New York Times over the summer, and in September he was with Reuters, and he had a visa from Reuters until the end of the year. In September, the paper hired him and applied to the Foreign Ministry to have his credentials transferred over to the New York Times. And by the end of the year, nothing had happened, despite repeated requests, a visit by the foreign editor, and so on. No response or anything, and so his visa expired, and on New Year's Eve he had to leave and go to Hong Kong with his family. So we're calling it a forced departure. The foreign ministry subsequently said, oh, the paperwork wasn't in order.
They said that Reuters hadn't actually informed them of his termination, right?
Right. Who knows? It's possible, but the paper had a lot of contact with MOFA, right. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs. The foreign editor was there. Nobody brought up anything at that point, but... if that's all it is, of course, it's easily rectified.
But this gives them at least some climb down, right? To be able to call it a bureaucratic snafu.
Right.
It gives them at least room to negotiate and save face.
I think the basic thing was that after the Wen Jiabao article appeared in October, there was an order just not to do anything about these visas. Mm-hmm. And probably... the people in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs probably were aware that the guy was going to have to leave with his family and pull his daughter out of school and so on, either were too scared to go upstairs and say, hey, if we don't do something, it's going to be really embarrassing. There's going to be a lot of questions. Or maybe they went along with it also and said, let's just teach him a lesson. Who knows exactly? It's a bit of a black box.
Okay. You guys have a take on this, on the situation with
Bunch of clowns, basically, is my take. I mean, really, come on, what kind of way is this to run a country in the 21st century? That period. I mean, not period, question mark. And then I stop. I mean, honestly, you know, playing games like this, making excuses like a child who said that, you know, the dog ate the homework. I mean, you know, come on. This is just totally unacceptable. It's China behaving like a school child. The Chinese government, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, whoever you care to blame, whoever's making the decisions, big demerit from me.
Ladies and gentlemen, Jeremy Goldcorn. Jeremiah, what's your take on this?
Well, I do think that this, the bureaucratic snafu has given them a, if, I hate to resort to cliche, but face-saving way to get out of this. One of the things I think is a little bit disturbing, though, has been the call on by some people, both China watchers and now even in the U.S., to in some ways retaliate against Chinese news services by, you know, cutting the number of visas or not approving visas for Chinese journalists who are trying to work abroad.
Clearly, you know, a good way to show our commitment to press freedom, right?
Yeah, I mean, I can understand there's the immediate, like, well, we'll show them. But I think that would be, you know.
But there's other ways to use the visa thing. For example, when the Xinhua senior bureaucrats are going off to visit their kid at Harvard or whatever, don't give them a visa.
You know? I could get behind.
Sort of a thing. And a lot of the people, China, I think, had 700 plus people who went to the U.S. on journalist visas last year. A lot of those people are cooks and IEs and people like that. These are not really journalists. So one could limit the numbers or have reciprocity, whatever.
And force Chinese journalists eat barbarian Western food?
Right, or just give the same number that we get. You know, I mean, for years and years, VOA was trying to get a second reporter. And they were told finally last year, you can't get a second visa because you're a government agency. And then the VOA person said, but Xinhua has like 500 people in the United States. Oh, that's different because they're a private company. I mean, this is a sort of ridiculous logic that's used. So there should be something because, yes, we don't want to limit press freedom, but the reality is that you're not exactly – it's not as if you're restricting journalists exactly. I hate to say it like that.
Right. And what's the situation with Phil Pan?
So he would be the new bureau chief for the New York Times, former Washington Post correspondent. He applied for a visa in March and still hasn't gotten it. That's a little, say, easier to understand because there have been very, very long processing times for visas for people coming from the outside. Whereas Chris Buckley was inside China, had a visa, just switching work units, so to speak. So Phil Pan still has to wait also.
Okay. Well, great. Are you optimistic generally? How do you feel about the odds that one or both of these situations will resolve themselves amicably?
I have a directive from the propaganda ministry in New York. No, I guess I don't.
Well, we know that's how the New York Times is run.
The rule of law.
What does your party secretary say?
What did Hillary tell you guys to say?
I think it'll work itself out, but it's going to take a bit of effort because these things are always complicated and rely, and you need a full court press to solve.
But this is why I do think that, you know, this kind of behavior is not acceptable, and they need to, no, they don't need to be comebacks. Maybe the United States actually doesn't care, and nobody cares. But if this kind of thing, this kind of behavior is to be discouraged, there should be some kind of comeback. And I also don't believe in excluding Chinese journalists from anywhere, but there are a lot of people one can exclude from a lot of different things that will not harm
the United States' reputation. Idea about, you know, going after, if you will, you know, denying visas to high-level, you know, propaganda ministry officials or Xinhua officials may be a better way than excluding.
We heard from French journalists that France did something similar when AFP couldn't get people accredited. And immediately the people got accredited. So you can try some stuff like that. Yes, it's a bit of chicanery, but you know, you got to fight fire with fire, I think, sometimes.
Right. Well, I mean, my personal preference is that we always take the high road. And I'd like to remind my friends on the journalist side too that there's plenty of room here on the dark side and the water's warm.
Yeah, so, you see, Kaiser, this is just very bad kind of behavior on your part too now.
Let's get to the section of our program where we do recommendations. Let me start here, and by way of this, make an announcement. We've got Tom Miller, who works over with Arthur Kroeber over at GavCall Dragonomics, terrific writer. He has just written a new book called China's Urban Billion, the story behind the biggest migration in human history. And he will be joining us next week on Seneca. I really look forward to talking to him about this. Here's what none other than Chris Buckley had to say about it from the back cover blurb. Quote, urbanization, well, I should do this in an Australian accent, though. I shouldn't. Urbanization will be the great theme of China's trajectory of the next decade and beyond. Okay, I'm sorry.
No, that doesn't work.
That doesn't work.
Do it in Russian, maybe, is better. Russian accent.
and Tom Miller is its superb streetwise guide. He expertly explains the economic, social, and environmental consequences of China's expanding cities and shrinking villages, and above all, never loses sight of the people at the heart of this transformation. Miller takes what could have been a dry, abstract topic and delivers a vivid and highly readable account of momentous changes. And I'm a few chapters into it, and I have to agree, this is a terrifically readable book, and it's chock full of great stats. This is going to be one of my big recommends for the whole year, no doubt. It's a great book. I highly recommend it. Okay, well, moving to my left here. Jeremiah, what you got for us this week?
So imagine there's a country with a tottering regime. Inside, there is a rebellion brewing, and the opposition forces are clamoring or pleading with the outside powers, particularly in the West, to recognize them in their quest to topple this despotic and this despotic regime.
It's autumn in the heavenly kingdom.
It is, in fact, autumn in the heavenly kingdom. China, the West, and the Epic Story of the Taiping Civil War by Stephen Platt. Very readable book. I thought it not just for people who are, you know, China history geeks like me, but anyone who's interested in kind of the notions of what it means to be a state, what it means to be a regime, and a rebellion. And there's a lot in there that it's hard to not look at the front pages of, say, the New York Times and think about what might have been in the 19th century.
Ian, you must really like this book.
Well, I haven't read it, to be honest.
Oh, you haven't. Okay.
I've heard very good things about it.
In fact, it was up for some big award, right?
It won.
It won. Actually. Oh, wow. Yeah, that was great. Yeah. So he's a protege of Spence, and it's really a beautifully written book.
Yeah. And published by Knopf or something. So I think a fairly mainstream, high-end publisher.
Yeah.
Well, the book I was going to suggest is Odd Arne Westad's Restless Empire, which is a 250-year survey of China's relations with the outside world. And to me, it's the kind of book that historians usually only write when they're very well established in their craft and profession and are able to step back and write the kind of book that doesn't get you tenure or whatever. But it's a very well-written book, and it sort of swings for the fences a bit, and it makes you think about things. Not everything works perfectly, but I think it made me think more about how this whole idea of reform and opening, which we always talk about it being 30 years of China opening up to the outside world, it's really been going on for a long, long time, and there was just this Maoist interregnum when it wasn't.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, not just the ROC period, but before that, even in the Qing, they were open to a lot of ideas, a lot of people going abroad to study, to learn. Chinese have been pragmatic for a long time, and I really got that from the book. And
the book also paint the kind of evil, eight foreign armies and Britain in a slightly more attractive light than is generally?
Well, thought. It doesn't focus on destroying the old summer palace and some of those things. It shows that, of course, he talks about these things as well, but he sort of shows this as part of an overall process that was going on at the time. And I think he also shows, in something that Frank Decotter does in his book on the Republican era, the positive role that foreigners played in the Republic era in the teens, 20s, 30s, building hospitals and schools and stuff like that, bringing these ideas into China. So that's also, I think, salutary. And I think he gives Chiang Kai-shek a lot more credit in the Civil War than people did. I mean, he sort of says this guy kept the country together, kept it fighting for the first time ever. China stood up to an outside country and didn't just cut a deal after an initial defeat. He just decided to nail his colors to the mast and to keep going. And the country almost collapsed, but, you know, I think that was also kind of interesting.
Yeah, so this sounds like it's definitely in the tradition of a book that I read some years ago by Joanna Whaley Cohen called The Sextants of Beijing. I don't know if any of you have read that, but it's also a book that sort of tries to blow apart this myth of China as a country that was in sort of this hermetic isolation for so very long. In fact, it looks at intercourse between China and other nations over many centuries. So that's a good book too. While we're on the topic,
You're looking at me.
Ian, one more time, the author of the book,
Odd Arne Westad, Westad. He's at the LSE. He's Norwegian.
Okay,
Westad.
Westad. Well, I will read the book. Very good. Thanks. Jeremy, you're up last.
Two quick things. One is follow the tweets of the journalist John Pomfret, also author of Chinese Lessons, whose last slightly cryptic tweet said something like, some speeches that I've seen when they're revealed will show everybody that Xi Jinping's not got any liberal reformist intentions and that he's just a mean poo-poo or something like that. But I'm quite looking forward to seeing what John Pomfret is going to reveal to us. That's the first recommendation. The second one is about our topic today, which I think that the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal both had some fairly good coverage of it. But I mean, I think hats off to David Bandersky at the China Media Project. If you're a nerd about this kind of thing and you want the like full, like 100-course meal, go to the China Media Project.
There's outstanding
a lot of stuff
coverage
about
yeah.
this whole event.
Let me just give a shout out to David, who was unable to come up for the show. We offered to fly him up from Hong Kong for to do this show because he would have been an invaluable resource. And we had to settle instead for Jeremiah and Ian. But thanks, David, for that. I mean, you've been a tremendous help to us in untangling this intriguing story. Anyway, and he will be in Beijing. It sounds like in the coming weeks, and although this story will have passed, there are always plenty of things to talk to David about. So look forward to that. Jeremiah, thanks for coming on, man.
Thank you, Kaiser. Thank you, Jeremy.
And for lending us the historical perspective that we can always count on you to provide. And Ian, thanks for coming back.
Thank you.
Jeremy, you got to chill out, man. You're just on the warpath, man. I'm gonna medicate you. Anyway.
No, I don't have to chill out. They have to stop being complete cunts. That's what has to happen.
You see what I mean? All right. Well, we will see. We'll see you guys next week on the Seneca podcast after I give Jeremy his medication. Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.